Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, as those of you listening know, we have a conversation live in the studio at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn about taste, really about food in general and food culture in specific. And today I'm very excited to have a guest who I think can enlighten us on some of the topics that have come up on programs, if you've been listening for the last year, I would say, where we've had chefs and food writers dealing with issues of immigration and American cuisine and trying to figure out what authenticity might mean in a market like New York City or in a country like the United States made up of people from other places and all the sorts of things related to what I would say the history of immigration in the United States and certainly to the idea or the ideology of America. And today we have someone who has spent a lot of time thinking about those sorts of things. With me in the studio is Hasia Diner, who is author and professor of Hebrew and Judaic studies and also of history and in particular immigration at New York University. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
So you have written much about immigrant ways, let's say not just food ways, but in particular a book that I loved called Hungering for America, which looked at Italian, Jewish, and Irish immigration food ways, I would say, and patterns, ways that they ate and their views of food. And I'm wondering, give us a little bit of perspective on that point in history, the 19th century, early 20th century, and its impact on American culture, in particular about food.
So the 19th century, particularly if we take the period, let's say, from the 1820s through the 1920s, which is really the kind of heyday of European immigration to the United States, and also, by the way, the migration from China and other parts of Asia, we find that, I mean, literally millions of people are coming to the United States from all over the world, while millions of people were going elsewhere also, Argentina, Australia, South. The United States drew not only the largest number of immigrants, but the largest variety of immigrants. So no place else attracted so many different kinds of people, speaking so many different languages, bringing with them ideas and attitudes and experiences that we bundle up calling that culture. And certainly within that was food.
Sure. And it, thinking about the rhetoric about immigration today, where so many people are trying to stop whoever coming across whatever ways or however means, was there something particularly at that time that was appealing besides it was someplace that wasn't Europe or where people were from?
So the United States was the most dynamic economy in the world. Mm. I mean, the takeoff from, again, the 1820s, well into the early 20th century, made it a place of just constantly expanding possibilities. I mean, here is this enormous swath of land where there are no internal borders. Okay? That is, if you took the same swath of land in Europe, you know, every X number of hours, you're crossing a border, right, and there's a tariff, and there's a tax, and there's a... Here is, you know, from New York all the way to California, from the north to the Mexican border, and obviously some Americans would have liked to extend it even further, uninterrupted land, and uninterrupted because the people who live there have been removed, and ripe for economic exploitation, and we could use that word either as a negative or a positive, and the more people came, the more economic opportunity it generated. And so one writer very ordinary person who comes to the United States in the early 20th century described it as the best poor man's country.
Which, interesting, because of course now we think of other places as that, the destination, Thailand, for instance, or something.
Right.
Especially with food. So lots of people are coming to this new place that perhaps is still trying to finagle an identity of some sort, and food is part of the reason for people to come in some ways, or lack of food perhaps.
Confrontation with hunger before migration was really one of the shaping forces that brings people from wherever to the United States. This was an economically driven migration, and people, again, in millions of communities around the world recognized that resources were dwindling in the places they were in. While it wasn't necessarily, in fact, for sure, it wasn't the poorest who came to America, we might say these were people who had enough of a confrontation with hunger. They saw it around them, around themselves, that they're willing to take the risk to come to a place where the assumption was, and it was a reality, that food existed in tremendous abundance. So we have, just as a beautiful little document, it's a lullaby, basically. It's a poem that was then set to music by the great Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem, who we know as the author of the Tevye stories that eventually becomes Fiddler on the Roof. And in the lullaby, the father has already gone to America, and the mother is crooning to the little child in the cradle and saying, you know, sleep, you know, pretty soon father will send us the ship's, you know, the ticket to come to America. And America is a place where you can have chicken soup and challah every day of the week.
Fascinating. So I remember perhaps that story from your class, which I was the beneficiary of as a student when I was at NYU, and that has come up in a contemporary context, because we're fighting now with the opposite of that, obesity and excessive calories and processed foods and too easy access to food. And one of the things that I keep banging is that if the idea of America is this place of abundance, that you can't just tell people to eat less food necessarily without putting it in the context of changing what it means to be America, because that ideology is strong. I mean, it brought millions of people here at one point. Which came first? The kind of question a historian hates.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that immigrants' understanding of America as a place where they were not going to experience famines.
Right.
Okay, as a place where even if they're members of the working class, working, laboring in some horrible coal mine or steel mill, by the way, even slave plantations, they're going to eat meat every day. I mean, this was something that was unimaginable to them. There's actually a wonderful little excerpt from one of the oral histories done at Ellis Island that's on the walls now in the museum there. And so a woman who was interviewed, and she'd come from Sweden at the end of the early 20th century, and she said while they were waiting to be processed, there was a very long line, and somebody came through with coffee and donuts. And her comment was, "I never had a donut before. It was so good." And so her image, in a way, of America was a place of, you know, obviously fat and carbohydrate and sugar. But also
out snacks outside of mealtime. They're standing online waiting for something, right?
And, you know, while I walk past a donut shop every day and I think, oh, my God, I wish I could afford the calories, you know, to sometimes have a donut, which I usually don't allow myself.
Right.
Thinking what this woman who had lived in a rural area in Sweden, who had the same meal three times a day.
That hard bread, the cold, hard, crispy cracker bread, right?
What it must have meant to sink her teeth into that donut. Or likewise, in the chapter on Italian immigrants to the United States and hungering for America, I quote a man who worked, and you can imagine how terrible his circumstances were, on a sugarcane plantation in southern Louisiana. I mean, just contract.
Go there,
labor,
right.
Terrible. But what he wrote to his brother, still in Sicily, was, life is hard, but the bread is soft. And so again, here I am, I look at a piece of white bread, and I think, oh my God, it's poison. And what that meant for this man, mm-hmm. for whom the only people who had eaten soft bread in his life before coming to America were rich people.
Right. See, to me, there's a profound meaning to this in the context of the food system issues, let's say, that we have today. You just can't erase that, even though it's generations away, that those ideas of the value of soft bread, of the abundance of donuts whenever you want them, because we are talking about people, a question that keeps coming up in conversations on the show and outside is, most of these people come from places we think of having strong food cultures and sort of cultural norms about how to eat and how much and in what context, and somehow it appears from us today that they just threw them all away and created this mess, let's say, that we have. But of course, this mess is founded on these ideas and this culture and this aspiration, let's say.
Right, and you could say, you know, the kind of bottom line is that America was a place of abundance.
Right.
And on top of that, we should keep in mind that the kinds of people who came as immigrants, again, we're talking about millions and millions,
right.
You know, 85, 90 million immigrants, you know, that they didn't necessarily, in the places they left, eat those meals that we associate with the sort of slow cooking and with fine ingredients and in a very, shall we say, dignified kind of way. These were primarily peasants. These were people who, day in, day out, ate the same meal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that food was a problem,
uh-huh.
and that their association of good food was what the rich people ate.
Right.
And so, again, in some of the Italian narratives, again, among the immigrant, talking about life in Sicily and southern Italy, from which most of the immigrants came to the United States, they said these were people who ate meat a few times a year, Christmas and Easter, the landowner would give meat to the tenant farmers. Okay, and sometimes we got meat because there was a dead animal on the road, and the landowner allowed us to cart it away and hack it up. Hmm. Now, what did it mean for them to be living in, you know, an anthracite coal region of Pennsylvania and be able to eat meat every day? Well, they're
it's
now...
like paradise.
A paradise. Right. And they now are reenacting, in essence, the kind of food that the landowner had grudgingly given them twice a year and let them hack up this carcass that had been found on the side of the road. They're doing it for themselves. It's their everyday experience. And no wonder America came to be for them a place of a positive place where abundance meant the chance to be something they had never been before.
Right. I feel like this all needs to be underscored even more because we're sitting here in a restaurant in Brooklyn and part of a new movement where people are trying to find some of these traditions, preserving foods, preserving meats and vegetables, growing your own things, the chickens in the backyard, and it's a wonderful time, I think, from the quality of food standpoint, but also culturally. Return is difficult when progress is in front of us in some ways, and the things that mean to us, the sort of food that we've come to appreciate is the peasant food that people spent generations trying to get away from, to eat the soft bread, to
right, and those peasant foods that we think they ate, they probably didn't eat. That is, they had a monotonous diet.
Right.
It was
even the students I taught from NYU, 1 week into a 3 week program in Italy, they think the diet is too monotonous. And they want to eat something besides Italian food, which Italians seem to eat every day, as far as I know.
Yeah, I mean, so in Italy, which in some ways provides us with just a really wonderful example of this, most of the immigrants who came to the United States would have never had, for example, something like tomato sauce.
Right.
This is, pasta was... They were often paid in small amounts of pasta by their employer.
Even olive oil, I understand, was a cherished item.
It drips and little drops of it.
Right.
And all the foods that we associate with, kind of authentic Italian food was not something that they ate before they came. So there was a wonderful memoir written by a man who came to the United States in the 1920s, who was already a government official, who was actually involved in olive oil exportation from Italy to the United States. And he was walking around Little Italy, and he saw these signs for something called the Italian restaurant. And so in his memoir, he said, I thought it was a joke because what's Italian food? So in other words, he understood Italian food as something that was regional and very specific to villages. So he says, I have to go in. I have to try this. And so he's, again, amused at that their dishes that say such and such Milanese from Milan and such Parmesan, obviously from Parma, and such Siciliano, so from Sicily. So he says, I'm going to order – I decided to order the most unusual thing on the menu.
Which
so
was?
What was spaghetti and meatballs? He said, I never heard of this before. And he says, it was so good. Somebody should send it back to Italy. People in Italy would love it too.
And did you hear that, all you foodie authentic police who sit there and think that just because it didn't happen there, it is can't possibly be good?
Yeah,
there you go.
So that these are invented traditions, and all traditions are invented. There's no such
thing. Right.
Right. And it was based on, one might say, this phenomenal fusion of American abundance. And the memories they had of what rich people ate back home. And in a way, they're saying, I'm going to actually, because nobody in Italy, in fact, would have eaten spaghetti and meatballs.
Right.
I'm going to best that my landowner, I'm going to best those rich people, and I'm going to now take my pasta and put meatballs
hysterical.
In it. I'm now going to be I'm going to, in a sense, by my consumption, I'm going to show how much I have achieved.
Right. We're going to take a quick break and think about that. I'm talking to Hasia Diner, who is a historian and professor of Hebrew and Judaic studies at NYU, author of Hungering for America, and we'll talk about her new work and a little bit about how we know these things and the process of making this kind of history. You're listening to Taste Matters. We'll be right back.
Today's music is by Obesity on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Hasia Diner, professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies and History at New York University. I'll remind people, if you're listening live, that you can call us with questions at 718-497-2128. Or if you prefer to write, or perhaps you're listening to the podcast, then send us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. We do have a question from a listener, which is picking up on this idea of the peasant, immigrant, let's say, and the difference between the foodways of rich and poor back home, America being the land of prosperity, at least where someone performed a sense that people were prosperous by eating meatballs on their pasta. Oh, my God. how could that be? But today, to bring this to a contemporary conversation, there's a huge disparity even today where we're eating these sorts of foods we associate with peasants in fancy restaurants, bowls, you know, simple salad. I don't even know what the connection is, but there is a class issue today that's been woven into our food system, let's say. And I think it's distinct in America because we are the land, quote unquote, without class, let's say. And I'm wondering, you know, we find ourselves in this moment where young chefs, many of them from immigrant families, and I would say second, third, and fourth generation, are going back to grandma and their great-grandparents and trying to find some place to, some roots to their cooking today, whether it's Italian or Chinese or Korean. And it's been a very exciting moment in food that, that these folks have become known for this fusion idea. But they're always asking, they're always challenging or being challenged by this concept of authenticity. And you said just before the break that all traditions are invented, and I would add change. Mm-hmm. And the notion that, that what even what the immigrants here ate, i.e. spaghetti meatballs, is different from what they ate or what they saw people eating back home. So do you think, I don't even know what my question is, comment on this phenomenon.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think, you know, to those young chefs and perhaps to the people who are eating those foods, don't worry if it's authentic or not, because since if a culture is a living, breathing organism, it changes.
Right.
Okay. And it has to go through new processes as it, since it's contingent on circumstances. And so rather than worry, is this authentic enough? Or enjoy it. Play with it.
Right.
Play with the food.
Which I think they're doing now, allowed to do now, I would say, which is what makes it so exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, if we think that most of the, you know, again, foods that we understand or we think of as being authentic to a particular place or to a particular culture were themselves once imported from someplace else.
Of course.
And so that Southern Italian culture generally had a very strong influence from Greece. Mm. Okay, it had a strong influence, in fact, from North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if it could change in the 14th century, in the 15th century, and in fact, obviously the pasta comes from elsewhere.
Right,
also,
and tomatoes are from here.
And
right.
We think of, let's think of a traditionally Northern Italian dish, polenta.
Right.
The corn comes from the New World.
Right.
So, you know, there's a moment where corn was brand new, and the chefs in northern Italy who start working, or the cooks who started working with polenta, with corn, were creating a fusion then.
Right.
It just happens to be a fusion we didn't live through.
Right.
And so that seems authentic, but to get a I don't know. Let's give an example. Something that makes me think it's just awful, but that's okay. You know, a blueberry bagel, a cranberry and Asiago cheese bagel, which seems to me just totally wrong.
Right.
It's no more wrong than people in northern Italy in the 16th century beginning to cook corn and develop an entire cuisine based on polenta.
Right.
Okay. It's just that we are living through this phenomenon, or so many of the foods that we associate with Jewish, quote, authentic Jewish delicatessen food, you know, corned beef and corned beef, pastrami,
right,
and so on. All products of the American melting pot. And so the pastrami Romanian Jews brought to the United States. The corned beef was German.
Mm.
Okay, East European Jews who came to the United States would have never seen a piece of corned beef in their life. It's something they meet in America, or lox.
Right.
Okay. This is something that's invented. It's again borrowed, naturalized.
Right.
Developed, picked up by others.
And then, at the case of bagels, then diffused to a point of neutrality where bagels and even ragalach just are things you find in a coffee shop in America, not even in a Jewish one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a brand of bread in Chicago that came in a plastic wrapper, and it was sliced, and it was sliced challah, but it said on the package, parentheses, said challah, H-A-L-L-A-H, parentheses, say holly. And so that, you know, that foods have always traveled from one group of consumers to another, and the next one who takes it puts their stamp
right
on it, and then it gets diffused further and further away. And one might say this is one of the this is a tribute to human adaptability.
Mm.
And while there certainly are elements in every culture that want to police the boundaries of their food system, one might say the fact that human beings can look into each other's pots and say, that smells good, I'd like to try it, is in some ways one of the more positive characteristics.
Human interactions, right.
And that it paves a way for cooperation between people. And while it may play havoc on those traditions which are elements, with the stewards, the guardians of tradition within various communities who want to put their hands out and say, no, you can't have that. There's the ability and the desire of people to want to eat beyond the boundaries of the familiar is something that I think one thing, it made migrations possible, and it made marriages across group lines possible, and the creating of the American common table. One might say the human, but certainly in our, since we're thinking about America, the human common table, the American common table possible.
Fascinating. One of the groups, we're going to run out of time before I get to all the wonderful things I want to talk to you, but one of the groups you spent a lot of time thinking about, obviously, are the Jews and the Jewish immigration, and there's an added level of religious observance when it comes to food that would make it difficult to reach into that pot in some ways. Although you could argue, since me and all of my friends love a good piece of bacon, that maybe we do, and that's a good thing. Right. Who knows?
The history of Jewish engagement with other people's foods is one that goes back to antiquity, because Jews were a mobile people who were spreading around whatever existed in the way of the known world, and every place they went, they engage with and confronted the foods of the people around them, and the inability to always bring the foods they had known from before. Right. So they had to improvise. And when they lived in close-knit and highly regulated communities, the Jewish dietary laws were not only observed, but they were policed by the communal authorities. But in the period of modernity, Jews move out into the world and had to figure out, in different Jews at different times, different individuals within the same community, the same family, negotiated differently. And so, you know, one person will say, I absolutely will never eat anything that isn't kosher. I will never eat in a restaurant, okay, other than, I will never eat in a restaurant. And others will say, well, you know what? I'll eat, but it has to be cold and uncooked.
Right.
Okay. And somebody will say, well, you know what? I'll eat fish. Okay.
Right.
Or I'll eat vegetarian, and so on and so on. So that there are, you know, multiple permutations of what this could mean. In the process, again, the way in which Jews, they reflect the ways in which Jews interacted with each other and with the larger society. Obviously, the Jewish dietary laws made this encounter fraught, okay? And probably interesting for a scholar, not me, because I haven't done it, but somebody should, on how halal and the Muslim dietary
adapted
restrictions.
Adapted or didn't, right?
Yeah, and how different elements within the Muslim population in the United States negotiate over that their boundaries. Mm-hmm.
So your most recent book actually gets right to this issue in some ways, called Roads Taken. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. So it's a study of Jewish peddlers. So the men who put backpacks on, strapped 100 pounds on their back, and went out on the road selling from house to house and mining camp to mining camp and logging camps and so on, selling consumer goods primarily to women all around the New World, the United States, South Africa, Australia, Canada, Latin America, the Caribbean. And they had a weekly cycle. So they would be out on the road 5 days a week and then return on the weekend to some small or larger hub of Jewish life, where they would pay their creditors, they'd get new goods. To start up again. They also would rest.
Right.
But during the week, the big issue they faced was, you know, where do I sleep and what do I eat? Mm. And so this, you know, in a sense, since we're talking about food, we'll look at the eating part of it. They had generally had very positive relationships with their customers. And the customers would say, well, you know, you can sleep here tonight, and would you like to eat? And sounds great, except, right. You know, the customers may be putting on their table pork or squirrel or bear right. or whatever. And each Jewish peddler had a different kind of way to negotiate this. And some of the memoirs and other kinds of, you know, personal documents that they left, they said, you know, I'm so hungry. I was out on the road 9 hours carrying 150 pounds on my back. It was miserable. It was mm-hmm. raining. And you know what? I'm going to eat anything that's put in front of me. Okay. Others said, I was going to eat anything. I'll eat anything that's put in front of me. And it was actually really good.
Right.
And yet others, and I'd say because these are primarily immigrants, mm-hmm. Most of them seem, at least again from the shreds and scattering of documents we have, to have said to the housewife who invited them to sit down, thank you so much, but I can't eat that food. And when she would say, well, why not? And you say, well, I'm Jewish, and my religion doesn't allow me to eat that. Most of them got the reaction from these women who were serving them was, what can you eat?
Oh.
And so in some cases, the peddlers would actually leave a pot, because they would go to the same houses every week.
Oh.
And they'd leave a pot there and cook for themselves.
Oh, interesting.
In other cases, the woman would prepare for them eggs, or bread, or fruit, vegetables. The Cherokee Indians, because the peddlers went on to Indian reservations, mm-hmm. used to refer to the peddlers as egg eaters, because they would eat an egg cooked in its shell.
Which would be kosher.
Yes,
right.
So it wouldn't violate the norm, mm-hmm. because the, in a sense, whatever contamination wouldn't have, that maybe was in the pot, wouldn't pass through the shell of the egg. And so in a way, food, while it's a barrier between these Jewish peddlers and their customers, because I can't eat that.
Right.
On the other hand, it's also a bridge, because the peddler not only, you know, well, the peddler is saying to this person, this is who I am, and part of who I am means I can't eat that. And so it becomes, if one wants to put it in super fancy language, a kind of on-the-ground, ecumenical, interfaith, educational, cultural exchange. Where, you know, this poor young man from Lithuania who's peddling in North Dakota or in the Australian outback or in the South African Transvaal teaches his customers mm-hmm. about Judaism and about what that means to him. And in some ways, the food becomes that little discussion about food. Our big discussion mm-hmm. about food becomes a building block to Jewish integration into these places and to the development of a ethos in these new world societies that Jews are okay. They're ordinary people who merely worship their God in a different way, but they have been in our home, sat at our table, slept in front of our fireplace, and they're okay. And this is such a contrast from the worlds they left, in which Jews occupied a demonized, marginalized status, and where their religion made them Christ killers and made them outsiders from civic life. Mm.
Fascinating. And that Rhodes Taken is out from Yale University Press
this fall. It will be out in the fall.
So, and you have a taste of it now. And I will say, as I sometimes do when I have such an eloquent guest who enlightens us about exactly why taste matters, I think that was a beautiful summation. And thank you so much for joining us. Next week, we are welcoming Miriam Arond, who is the director of the Good Housekeeping Institute. Not unrelated in some ways, this idea of housekeeping, hospitality, what it means to be good, let's say. Should be an interesting conversation. In the meantime, Hasia, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. It was really fun.
And thank you for listening. Before next week, why don't you, why don't you look for an immigrant food stuff and try to figure out yourself, you know, what its level of authenticity is, whether it matters, what makes it delicious, and maybe how it got there. So always encouraging our listeners to be mindful of what they eat, because, of course, taste matters. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.